Hello and welcome to The Stack. This week we speak with the team behind The Point magazine on a book celebrating 10 years of the publication. Plus Jessica Lessing, founder of The Information, a successful tech and business news site. And we welcome back Rob Pinney from Point 51, a wonderful title exploring the essential contemporary issues across Europe. Enjoy the show. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis, and I am Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Coming up on the show, we speak with Jessica Lessing from tech and business news site The Information, plus Rob Pinney, editor of Point 51. But first, I speak with the team behind The Point magazine. The title ethos is a humanistic one, avoiding hot takes and petty polemics. In a new book titled The Opening of the American Mind, 10 years of The Point, they trace some of their highly acclaimed essays, from Barack Obama's presidency to the 2020 election. To talk about the book and what's next for The Point, I spoke to the title's founding editor, John Baskin, and editor, Anastasia Berg.
We started the magazine when I was a graduate student at University of Chicago, and I started it with two colleagues in this program called the Committee on Social Thought that we were in. And the idea of our program was sort of to read great books in light of their direct relevance to our lives and to our culture and to our politics and to our personal lives. But it was still an academic program. So when we went to write about these things, the things we were studying in our classes, we still had to write for a kind of academic audience. And the idea of the magazine was to see if we could sort of take some of the values we from the program, this idea of sort of, you know, the examined life and its relevance to our everyday lives, and write for a general interest audience, not just for other academics, and write about, you know, the way we would talk about our classes after class. And if we could put that in a kind of magazine and examine our own culture and our own lives. And so that was really the idea of the magazine. That was sort of the genesis of the idea. And we started it in 2008, right as Barack Obama was becoming president, and in the South Side of Chicago. You know, initially we didn't see the magazine as primarily political. We saw it as a sort of philosophical or humanistic project. But as the years went by, the sort of commitment to this examined life sort of prior to politics became itself more and more of a political act. And in a funny way, we kind of think there are sort of different foundings of the magazine. And as we got closer to the Trump years and stuff, the magazine really changed in sort of how it spoke to people in the American space. And that sort of brought us closer to where Anastasia started to come on into the magazine.
I was going to ask Anastasia, what's your connection with The Point? For how long have you been there?
Right. So I joined right before the 2016 American election. And this was a time where, as we all remember, and it's still a time we live in today, where people were starting to be really concerned about polarization and about how can we resist these echo chambers that were being created around us and locking us in them. And I realized at the time, just as I was joining, that I thought that this is something that The Point has been doing since its founding moments. And it was doing it not just by, like we see around us today, critiquing polarization or pointing fingers and blaming particular factions for being responsible for polarizations, but just by really modeling an alternative. And that was an alternative that wasn't just about being nice and polite. It wasn't about manners, and it wasn't about kind of pretending to listen to the other side, because that's the strategic way of advancing your agenda. But it was really about getting people from drastically, dramatically different backgrounds to weigh in on the issues that really mattered to them and to us. And that means geographically separated people, politically, religiously, educationally, socioeconomically, and having them all come in, weigh in, model this kind of disagreement. And I think that was what I was so excited about while I was joining. And I realized that that is the sort of responsibility that we have now, which is really to continue doing that. And that's what we've been doing in the years to come. And that's what also we decided to highlight with this anthology, this thread that kind of goes through all these years of having the magazine, where we have been showing people how you can very strongly disagree and very earnestly take seriously the people that you disagree with, not because you're moderate, not because you don't care, not because you're a centrist, but because that's what makes you a thoughtful person.
Well, those are very wise words, Anastasia. And Joan, just returning to you, I think perhaps because that's why, you know, readers enjoyed the points, not only the United States, because precisely because of this thoughtful dialogue. And as Anastasia was saying, of course, you don't need to be a moderate, but, you know, you can treat people's opinions with respect. I mean, we see social media today. I mean, even, you know, the American president, he loves tweeting. Everybody likes to be a polemic these days, in a way. I think the point is precisely the opposite of that, right?
Yeah, I think this is always something readers have responded to in the point. I mean, the length of the articles, this sort of depth and the sort of kind of humanistic background, it all is a way of pushing against not just polarization, but a certain kind of superficiality and thinness that I think a lot of people feel in our discourse, and not even only just in sort of the news media, but even in a lot of what passes for intellectual discourse in our culture. I think a lot of people feel a kind of knee-jerk quality to it. And I think the point from the beginning, has always pushed against that. And it sort of speaks, even though that wasn't, you know, the intention, like I said, came out of a sort of positive value of how do we take the sort of values of the humanities and the examined life and put them into a form which is not just for academics or specialists, but that speaks to the problems that people have every day. But I think that increasingly that's also become a sort of refuge for people from what they experience in the media on a daily basis.
And Anastasia, let's talk as well about the book that you've just published as well. Is it kind of a compilation of the best essays of the magazine in the last 10 years? Do you think that's a good starting point for someone who perhaps don't know much about The Point magazine, but might become interested because of the book as well?
I think it's definitely a great place to start if you're curious about our project. I don't know about saying these aren't necessarily our best essays. As I was saying, I think they're great. I think they're just really incredible essays that were unfortunately left out. I think, as I was saying in my previous answer, that we had to make a real choice about what to highlight. And we decided to highlight a certain way in which over the past 10 years, The Point has been able to comment on the American, also global, but mostly the American experience politically and socially and culturally. And so we had to make some tough choices. I think they're great essays that were left aside.
Joan, how did you decide to divide the book? You know, because there is a certain division the way the chapters were made.
Yeah, I mean, I would say we were actually quite conscious of not just wanting to make this a compilation. There are many, some of my favorite essays from the history of the magazine are not in here. There are more on topics, you know, that maybe, but we wanted the book to sort of tell a specific story. And it was a story we only really recognized in retrospect as we looked back over the first 10 years of the magazine. And I think you'll see that reflected in the chapters of the book. So the book starts with sort of when the magazine started, which was 2008, in the midst of the financial crisis, essentially, in America. The first essay in the book is about how the sociologist Thorstein Veblen can help us think about the U.S. financial crisis and the role of Wall Street in America and finance and in modern economies more generally. And then the first section, which is called The End of History, is sort of about this dawning recognition that we're starting to, even though it's an interesting time because on the one hand, you had this kind of hope in America with Obama being elected, especially among the intellectuals. On the other hand, you had the financial crisis and a sort of dawning recognition that certain structures and ways of doing politics that had been sort of a consensus way of doing things for a long time were starting to crumble. And one of the neat things is you can go back and look at these essays from 2008 and 9 and 10, and you can really see reflected, I think, a lot of hints about what's to come in American politics. And I mentioned to you, you know, there's an essay about the death of Margaret Thatcher, about Fukuyama, various different themes on the sort of like end of a certain kind of consensus around neoliberalism and liberalism, even in some cases, in America and England especially. And I think the chapters then follow from that. You see the reemergence of a sort of really passionate form of social movements in America with the After Ferguson chapter, which is three incredible essays about sort of the beginnings of some of the racial justice movements that we see coming up again in the last summer. And then we have a chapter essentially about the sort of beginnings and of the Trump presidency, which comes after that. And then you have, just looking now, make sure I don't leave anything out, but and then you sort of have bringing us up to the present moment and thinking about not only the Trump presidency of sort of what it's meant politically, but what it means for intellectuals. And that's where one of the titles of the book, The Opening of the American Mind, we really meant to trace a movement. We meant to have two meanings. On the one hand, to trace a kind of opening as Americans and what we think of as possible in our politics, both for better and worse. And then also a sort of imperative to intellectuals to think about what it means to keep an open mind during a period of this kind of polarization that Anastasia was talking about earlier. And that becomes really a theme of the last couple chapters of the book, essays that really speak to what it means to remain open-minded and to resist the forces that are pushing us toward a kind of dogmatism, closing ourselves off from our fellow citizens, which can be very tempting to a lot of people.
And Anastasia, I'm just curious about your readers. I mean, I know, of course, you have a print title as well. How's your online presence these days? I mean, we have an election coming up in just a few weeks' time. Will you try to cover this in your own way, or the readers perhaps we have to wait, you know, for kind of a more kind of measured analysis of the results of what happened and what's next in the United States?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I'll say something, and I think we should let John also talk about a special, very special project that's happening in our current issue. But I'll say something general, which is there is a quality of our essays that we're very proud of, which is that we think when we do it right, there's an untimeliness to the essays. There's a quality of them that allows people to pick them up years after they were written and still find them refreshing and surprising and interesting. This is why we think part of the strength of the anthology that we've put up, while also trying to really respond to the moment. Because as John was saying, and as I was trying to say, we really think that this kind of what can seem a little bit highbrow, it can seem challenging, it can seem very subtle, is a way of leading our own personal, urgent, daily, thoughtful lives. For this issue in particular, we've done something that we haven't done before, which is a project, a sort of kind of an oral history that tries to comment and relate to the protests that have just occurred in the US. And what was guiding us in doing the project is sort of the thought that different magazines, like you were saying, and online, people have, from the very first moment, tried to determine the meaning. What does this mean? What is the significance of this event? And kind of tried to write it in stone. And we thought, if we want to understand what this event means, we need to understand what it means to the very different people who came out and were on the ground and were living this experience. And so that's what we did. We went out, we interviewed sort of dozens of different participants, from people who were activists their whole lives to people who are going out for the first time ever on the streets, and asking them why they did it and what it meant to them and what did they see, and how it did or didn't change the ways that they were viewing their lives and the kind of political reality in America.
That was John Boskin and Anastasia Berg from The Point. Their book is called The Opening of the American Mind, 10 Years of The Point. Staying in the U.S., I also spoke with Jessica Lessin, founder and editor-in-chief of The Information. The subscription-only website is a successful story with a 40-plus operation. Besides talking a bit more about The Information, we also discussed the rise of journalists turning to paid newsletters and how that is a good thing.
We are a technology business publication that does in-depth, inside, behind-the-scenes reporting about the most powerful tech companies. And our audience is CEOs and decision-makers and leaders in the technology industry who are looking to get ahead and to get the real story about what's happening in this very tumultuous space right now.
Well, very much so. And Jessica, it's quite interesting. You mentioned, of course, you have to pay a price. You're online. But I remember there was a time when people For some reason, they believed that information should be free online, but clearly that method didn't work. I mean, most newspapers these days and big media companies, they are using paywall. I think that's, in a way, kind of journalists discovering their worth in a way. So tell us a bit more about that.
You know, I couldn't agree more. When I started The Information almost eight years ago, I had been a technology reporter at the Wall Street Journal. And I felt like the idea that information should just be free meant basically that information wouldn't be worth very much, because I believe that you sort of get what you pay for in news as well as anything else. And so what we've tried to do with The Information is to say, what value of journalism would be worth paying something? And then to make sure that our reporting, whether it's breaking big news or behind the scenes profiles, data, org charts, you name it, would be worth that. And I think what we've seen over the past several years is really this slowly growing understanding that as publishers, as journalists, we should be embracing, not rejecting, kind of the economic value that our work brings. And I think recognizing that as an industry is key to sustainability and growth.
And tell us about, you know, your subscribers. You know, I believe you pay a fee yearly, or, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but do you have kind of different types of subscription, or is it just one unique fee for everyone?
We do have a few varieties. I mean, our core subscription is about $1 a day. It's about $3.99 a year US. And so certainly a premium product, but something that we think, given the business intelligence that we could provide, you know, is a wonderful deal. And that is our core offering. We wanted to keep it simple. And I think we do have a more premium package that includes a lot of event features and things like that. But really, and to my surprise, frankly, our pricing hasn't changed much since the day we launched, because I think what we're finding is it is a sweet spot where our content is resonating at that price. People realize it's premium, but they want to invest in, you know, getting some quality news. I mean, I think it's no secret that what's out there on a day-to-day basis is a really wide variety of quality. There's a lot of misinformation. There's still a lot of lazy journalism. And so our subscribers, whether they're first-time entrepreneurs starting their, you know, very first companies, all the way up to the, you know, the CEOs of the 10 largest tech companies subscribe to The Information, you know, I think people are finding that it is worth it. And I think that's, you know, it's bigger than us, right? And in a sense, I think this is the change that needs to happen for journalism to be able to invest in the kind of quality information gathering we need as a society.
Jessica, what's kind of your connection or the information connection with all kind of the big tech companies? Because, you know, I believe you're based in San Francisco. I mean, you're close to many of them as well. You are more or less where things happen in that sense, right?
We are out in the Bay, where we have a lot of access in terms of, you know, there are a lot of sources to call. I think, and I'm proud of this, we've really earned a reputation of being quite tough on the tech industry. When I started the publication 8 years ago, I felt that tech coverage was too hypey. It was too celebrating founders, and there wasn't enough scrutiny of the business and of the influence on society. And so I often hear from tech companies that when our reporters call, they call their lawyers before they call us back, because they want to know what kind of things we've dug up that they're not happy about. So I think, you know, while we're fair, we're tough. And I think that is what the industry demands. That's kind of our reputation in the space, and one that I think is very important at this time.
And Jessica, I know you wrote kind of about the topic as well. So how do you see, I mean, more and more I'm seeing, even here in London, we have, for example, there's this new kind of newsletter website about food, the food industry here in London, where you have to pay for it. How do you see those kind of things happening? More and more kind of journalists are creating their own space, being via paid newsletter or website and charging for it in a way. How do you see that? Or if you have any tips, if someone wants to create one?
I think it's a wonderful trend, and 3 years ago, we started an accelerator program at The Information where we mentor and work with journalists thinking of starting or just started subscription newsletter businesses. And in working with them and our own experience, I think it is a fabulous trend that speaks to journalists embracing the sort of economic potential of their work and, you know, getting themselves sort of the freedom to do the kind of work they want that they may not be finding in traditional newsrooms. I think, like all things, it will be uneven and people will use it for different reasons. Some will turn it into amazing standalone businesses. I think others will use it in complement to something else. But I think we have so many proof points now that it is possible, whether it's an individual who wants to do it or, you know, to build out a team and do it, if the quality is there, if the product is there, I think reader appetite is there as well. And what I say to journalists approaching me about it is I sort of say, well, can you do something 10 times better than someone else? Is your coverage of the food industry, the fashion industry, the technology industry, something that can be very differentiated? And if it is, if your perspective, if your sourcing is truly excellent, I think there is tremendous potential. So I always encourage, I think sometimes journalists like to go broad, and I like to encourage them to go deep. I think that's a key thing that's necessary to building up a subscription business, whether it's a small newsletter or a larger publication. And it's very exciting to see the activity happening right now. Obviously, it's happening too because the barriers to entry are so low. You know, to start an email list, to add payment to that, there are so many wonderful companies that make that very easy. And there are challenges down the line. You know, I think once you imagine many of these creators and writers will get a really solid initial audience, there are a lot of blocking and tackling tactics to scale that, to continue to grow. But our experience has been that quality journalism and information is the heart of that. And if you have that, there's really, you know, almost limitless potential.
That was Jessica Lessing there from The Information. And if you're interested in subscribing to it, just go to theinformation.com. And now I'm happy to welcome back to The Stack Rob Pinney, editor of Point 51, an indie title exploring contemporary issues across Europe. The theme for issue 3 is resilience, with stories ranging from the demanding lives of shepherds in the mountains of northern Albania to a story about carers in Porto. Here is Rob with more.
So our last issue came out in November of last year, and we've been working on this issue since then. So we'd originally planned for it to come out in May of this year, but because of the nature of the reporting we do, it involves putting people on the ground, often for extended periods of time. It wasn't possible for us to ask people to continue to do that work. So we had to introduce a short delay, but I think it's made the issue stronger as a whole. The stories are relevant to the time and the moment that we're in a variety of different ways, but they're not all directly connected to the pandemic itself. So I think there's lots of value in it in a more lateral and connected sense too.
Well, and you're very right. I mean, your magazine, you know, it is about kind of in-depth reporting. You know, usually the writers, they have to go to the place where things are happening, or the photographer. And I'm glad that continues because I know COVID brought so many challenges to you. But you're right. The variety of stories here is fantastic. I was very impressed. There's the story about the shepherds in the mountains of northern Albania. You know, something that I had no idea. But, you know, then you become so involved with their story reading your magazine.
That's a story by photographer and journalist Nick Sinoga, who is actually one of our contributing editors now, and we worked with him on the last issue as well. It's a story about a group of shepherds that live between the lowlands and then the higher pastures in the mountains of northern Albania. And they're one of the last remaining groups to practice something called transhumance, which is where you seasonally migrate flocks of sheep so they can graze on pastures at higher altitudes in the summer months. But it's also a story about, I mean, a very difficult and challenging way of life. It's very physically demanding. But then there's also a kind of, I guess, a beauty in that. And Nick explores that and contrasts it with his own experiences in the story as well.
Another very fascinating and emotional story is the one of the caregivers in Portugal. And, you know, although it's not entirely COVID related, I mean, I think we can say that it is a little bit related, especially when we talk about the elderly being the most affected about this disease as well. But the photography, again, extremely emotional and very, you know, it feels that the photographer is very close to its subjects in a way.
Absolutely. So, I mean, this is a photo essay that we've been working on, well, for almost a year with Teresa, the photographer. It's a photo essay about her mother and grandfather, and her mother is an informal caregiver for her grandfather. She started shooting this, I mean, quite some time ago, and it wasn't supposed to be something that was COVID related or connected to the pandemic. But obviously, when lockdown measures were introduced in Portugal and in Porto, the city that she lives in, it brought a whole new dynamic to their lives within the four walls of their flat. But Teresa continued to photograph that for us throughout the lockdown period. And I mean, you're right, it's an emotional, raw, visceral account of that experience. But it's also extremely intimate and loving. And I mean, as Teresa says in the introduction to the piece, you know, her mum's one of about 800,000 informal and unpaid caregivers undertaking that work in Portugal, that she sees the body of work as ultimately a tribute to her mum and a kind of a testament to her strength and the things that she's going through.
And Rob, just for those perhaps who don't know much about your title, Point 51, the whole idea is to bring kind of contemporary stories about Europe. And does that still remain very strong within you? You know, even though we're based here in the UK, of course, we had Brexit and everything. Is it very much a kind of a European title in that sense, in its soul?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, from the very beginning of working on this project, you know, several years before we even released the first issue of the magazine, we were very clear in our minds about what we wanted it to be. And that was a pan-European magazine. So we didn't want it to be rooted in the journalistic and photographic tradition and culture of one particular country. I mean, we're sort of headquartered notionally out of London, but I mean, our editorial team is currently split between here, Dublin, Boston in America, and Sarajevo. All of the photographers and journalists that we work with under normal circumstances, they'd be constantly moving around. And we're very careful to make sure that the balance of stories is something that's representative of the continent and the different countries and regions within it.
Well, I'm looking here at the contributors page, and it is fascinating. It is very much this idea of European. You have a Portuguese photographer, you know, a documentary photographer based in Bosnia and Albania. Do you know what I mean? It is. You can feel it that you're definitely trying to spread the stories all over the continent in a way.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, we're also very committed to working with a range of different people on these stories. So I mean, you know, we're not especially interested in commissioning really famous photographers, for example. We're interested in commissioning people that are engaged with particular topics that we want to work on, that are already working on things that we think are important, and that are interested in working with us on those topics and themes for longer periods of time. And I think when you open up yourself and your magazine and your pages to that kind of more varied group of contributors, you're naturally going to get a more representative spread. But I mean, I think in our case, it's completely essential to what we're trying to achieve with the magazine anyway.
That was Rob Penny from Point 51. Issue 3 is out now. That's it for this week's show. My thanks to our editor, Nora Hall. And if you have any comments or queries, feel free to write to me, Fernando, at fp@monaco.com. And remember, we're back next Saturday at the same time. And of course, you can always listen to it again at monaco.com. And please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or SoundCloud. But first, we have a little song for you. Information Society with What's on Your Mind, Pure Energy. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.
It's worked so far, but we're not out yet.
I wanna know what you're thinking. There are some things you can't hide. I wanna know what you're feeling. Tell me what's on your mind.